Sound now? Yes? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So would you agree that if we have a foundation principle that there's just one presence, one power at work in our lives and in the universe, God the good, that when we inadvertently have someone or something against us, you know, we can have that as our belief, but still in our life have an exception to that. But it's important that we know that whenever we have an exception to the principle that there's just God going on in our life, that that exception, whatever we're having, a life experience that looks and feels against us, that it can only be that way when we are living in the disconnect. Can you accept that on principle?
Yeah. Yeah.
That when we are living separate and apart from our own sense of well-being and worth, it's possible that the circumstances of our life can look and feel against us. But they're not really against us. They're really a mirror unto that part of us that is not connected to the conscious awareness that we're God made, that we're worthy, that we're more than enough. Last time when I was talking a couple weeks ago, I said whenever we're challenged by whatever we're having in our life, if we relate to the experience as either being a mirror to our own disconnect, or a portal to that dimension of ourself where we transcend whatever is happening in our world. We can be in the experience of being in the world, but not of it. And so I'm wanting us to kind of consider, especially in light of my talk title, Down the Rabbit Hole, which, by the way, I was asked by Jane, can you have Down the Rabbit Hole as your title, talk title? And I thought to myself, well, sure I can, because going down the rabbit hole, I mean, we're all familiar with Alice in Wonderland and What the Bleep, and we are fascinated by that dimension of what can be the realm of possibilities, how it can emerge in our life. And even though we need the childhood fantasy of Alice in Wonderland, we really need to do this deeper work of going down that rabbit hole and really understanding what reality is. I mean, what is reality, really? I mean, we don't spend a lot of time thinking about this, bless you, but we have to take into account that we create our own personal reality through the thoughts we have and the beliefs that we hold and how we feel about things. That generates our felt experience and how we be with what's happening in our life. But the pivotal question is that are we being with our life as if it's for us, or are we being with our life experience as if it's against us? And either way, we're creating a life experience. It doesn't matter if our life looks for us or not, but how we intend how our life is unto us is a part of the reality that we generate as our experience. In looking, going down the rabbit hole and really being in this question, what is the fundamental foundation of reality? We have to also be in the fundamental question of what is the universe? What is this experience that we're having? Last week, Jane talked about this podium, this lectern, and said, it's not really solid. We just have the experience of it being solid. And she quoted quantum scientist Werner Heisenberg, who said that atoms or elementary particles themselves are not real. And here's a quantum scientist saying that nothing that is solid is real, that any form of the world is really a potentiality of possibilities. And yet our senses, our whole being has this sense that this is solid, but yet the science behind it says that it's mostly empty space. And yet what makes it solid are forces at work. And quantum scientists consider four fundamental foundational forces: gravity, electromagnetic field, and what's called strong and weak nuclear forces that affect how the quantum dimension works. And so the reason why this is solid is because of those forces at work. But as soon as that we understand the deeper dimension of what is actually a happening when we enter into a relationship with this field of infinite possibilities, with the field that is underlying the material world. We have to kind of recognize that everything that is something in the outer arises from an invisible field of consciousness, of a field of potentiality, that there's nothing really solid out there that doesn't have its counterpart in consciousness, in this area of thought or principle. So what I'm wanting to do before I get started here is I'm wanting to share a clip from the movie What the Bleep, features Dr. Quantum, who's going to be talking about the infamous double slit experiment. And in this double slit experiment, what is discovered is that our perceptions are just what we notice interacts with what is happening in our life. And if we can understand these principles, then we have a measure of empowerment that we can muster when it comes to working with the conditions of our life. So let's start with this.
And here we are, the granddaddy of all quantum weirdness, the infamous double slit experiment. To understand this experiment, we first need to see how particles, or little balls of matter, act. If we randomly shoot a small object, say a marble, at the screen, we see a pattern on the back wall where they went through the slit and hit. Now, if we add a second slit, we would expect to see a second band duplicated to the right. Now, let's look at waves. The waves hit the slit and radiate out, striking the back wall with the most intensity directly in line with the slit. The line of brightness on the back screen shows that intensity. This is similar to the line the marbles make. But when we add the second slit, something different happens. If the top of one wave meets the bottom of another wave, they cancel each other out. So now there is an interference pattern on the back wall. Places where the two tops meet are the highest intensity, the bright lines, and where they cancel, there is nothing. So, when we throw things, that is, matter, through two slits, we get this, two bands of hits. And with waves, we get an interference pattern of many bands. Good, so far. Now, let's go quantum. An electron is a tiny, tiny bit of matter, like a tiny marble. Let's fire a stream through one slit. It behaves just like the marble, a single band. So, if we shoot these tiny bits through two slits, we should get, like the marbles, two bands. What? An interference pattern! We fired electrons, tiny bits of matter, through. But we get a pattern like waves, not like little marbles. How? How could pieces of matter create an interference pattern like a wave? It doesn't make sense. But physicists are clever. They thought maybe those little balls are bouncing off each other and creating that pattern. So they decide to shoot electrons through one at a time. There is no way they can interfere with each other. But after an hour of this, the same interference pattern is seen to emerge. The conclusion is inescapable. The single electron leaves as a particle, becomes a wave of potentials, goes through both slits, and interferes with itself to hit the wall like a particle. But mathematically, it's even stranger. It goes through both slits, and it goes through another. And it goes through just one, and it goes through just the other. All of these possibilities are in superposition with each other. But physicists were completely baffled by this. So they decided to peek and see which slit actually goes through. They put a measuring device by one slit to see which one it went through and let it fly. But the quantum world is far more mysterious than they could have imagined. When they observed, the electron went back to behaving like a little marble. It produced a pattern of two bands, not an interference pattern of many. The very act of measuring or observing which slit it went through meant it only went through one, not both. The electron decided to act differently, as though it was aware watched. And it was here that physicists stepped forever into the strange, never world of quantum events. What is matter? Particles or waves? And waves of what? And what does an observer have to do with any of this? The observer collapsed the wave function simply by observing.
You get that, Colton? Yeah? Okay. So, this is important for us to recognize that in the context of quantum science, the observer, us, we collapse the field of infinite possibilities into one inevitable happenstance. That's what we do. And when we put 7 billion people together, we create a kind of race consciousness or a collective consciousness that collapses the field of infinite possibilities into the insanity that we are experiencing in these times. And so we contribute to the morphogenic field through our perceptions and meaning making. And we in turn do our share of contributing to either the craziness or the equanimity, depending upon how we are collapsing the field in our own personal life experience. So we can use this principle to understand what Jesus had to say when he was trying to instruct his disciples to be present to life and be an avenue through which the Spirit of God can manifest, as opposed to be dealing with the effects of life, the outer conditions of life. And so he says, the light is the lamp of the body. If thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light. But if thine eye be evil, thy whole body shall be filled with darkness. How great is the darkness? And so he was describing how perception, the eye is the organ of perception, how perception is relevant to the quality of our life experience. And so what is the single eye as a context of how we are looking out at our life? And what is if our eye is evil, how does that shift the context as how we look at our life, and how does that collapse the field into a darkness, into a kind of duality? And so as we recognize this principle of the observer effect, and as we look at what Jesus had to say, the eye is the lamp of the body, he's not referring to the physical eye, he's talking about a principle of perception. Because the eye does not see. The eye is simply an organ that allows the light spectrum to enter into and be cast upon a backdrop called the retina, which is excited by the photons that generates electrochemical signal that is carried through the optic nerve to the visual cortex. And it is our brain that then interprets those messages and creates the image within here that we project onto the outer experience that we're having in our life. Now, we can see what we see doesn't necessarily come from what's out there, but it comes from where we are seeing from. And we can see how the context from which we are having our life then informs how we organize our attention and awareness and what we make our experience mean to us. So we can better understand this, that it is the I that is the lamp of the body, my own sense of I am. And whatever I reduce my beingness into then becomes the context or the field within which I'm having my experience. The field is the sole governing agency of the particle, Albert Einstein says. And so let's look at the three I's of our way of being in our life. The first is I am what I have or what I don't have. And think about the times when you've confused yourself with what you have or don't have. In other words, we tend to suffer when what we have is undesirable or we don't have what is needed. And therefore, when our identity is linked into the experience of reducing ourselves to the outer sense of whether or not we're okay or not, depending upon the outer condition, we're sourcing our well-being and the discomfort out there in the effects of life and never being able to really connect up with the cause. And so this is why we're working towards understanding what the portal is, the portal to that dimension of ourself that can shift our attention out of the conditioned dynamic of our life and into a place where we can actually decide how we're going to be with what's happening in our life. and determine the way in which we're going to bring into the expression of the moment a greater sense of truth, a greater sense of who we are. So we know we suffer when we confuse ourselves with what we have. And when we create a collective reality out there that defines us, then there's scarcity out there. There's the haves and the have-nots. But when we recognize that that arises from consciousness, from a place within the humanity's collective unconscious self, then we have to extricate from ourselves from that, because we're affected by it. I mean, are we not being modulated by what's happening in the news about the coronavirus, about politics? We're all feeling something based upon what's happening in the outer. But what I'm suggesting is that we can lift ourselves out of being modulated by that and instead come from a place that begins to put energy into that very experience and begins to shift it into a healthier place. And the same thing applies when I confuse myself with what I can do or what I can't do. I'm investing my identity, my beingness, in the dynamic of being able to manage the external world. And we all know that when we can't do something that we really want to do, we suffer. Or when we're doing something that we're not supposed to be doing, we suffer. And so we can see how our doing, when it's linked to dealing with the conditions of the outer, instead of being prompted by our higher self, instead of being answering the call that lives in the context of that voice that is telling us that we're whole, that we're okay, that we're the one, if we're not coming from a place that is not tethered to our brokenness, our fractured, our limited self, then we're not coming from the wholeness that is a part of our identity. But there is a third eye, the dimension of ourself, not to be confused with the mystical chakra, but rather that place within us where we're not bridled to any condition in the outer. We can be whoever we want because there's no outer condition that limits our choice to be. We are by definition in this energetic dimension of beingness, and then we reduce ourselves to what we have or can do, as opposed to who and what we've come here to be. So in this dynamic, we have to recognize that we collapse the field of infinite possibilities whenever we use I am. Whenever we speak those words and we attach it to something that lives out there, we are beginning to collapse that field into that point of limitation. But when we can recognize that we have the capacity to align ourselves with a dimension of mind that can, move us into an expression of wholeness in the context of our inner connection with the all, with everything, then we can be in this world empowered to make a difference. And so as I contemplate this whole dimension of the challenges that we face, I'll let this sink in while I just banter with some idle conversation. The idea here is that we cannot see, we cannot perceive, we cannot look out without seeing ourselves as a part of that view. And so if we can know in principle that I cannot see my life without myself in the view, then I have to compensate for that limited capacity. Because if everything is in the context of how it affects me, I'm living in the experience of somebody, in someone, something, somewhere, and some time, and I'm conditioned by my habits of being. But if I can extricate my sense of who I am and know that, yes, my conditioned self is locked into a virtual reality, but that's not the all of me, that's just a part of me that is asleep. But as I wake up and I become conscious, I can become aware of my connection and my oneness and my wholeness and my sense that I'm enough. I can't be aware of those things when I'm stuck in my conditioned self. So I have to have a means by which I can intervene when I am stuck and lost in my own misperception. And it's helpful for us to be in the default mode of saying that everything that I look at, any perception that I have, is really misperception, because it comes from a place in me that's incomplete. I'm perceptually incapable of seeing life as it really is when I'm living out of my unconscious self. And I know I'm living out of my unconscious self when I'm having someone or something against me. Because I know when I'm having someone or something against me, I'm in the disconnect. And so when I have a system that begins to help me wake up, when I can understand that the things I'm looking at, if it bothers me or disturbs me, I know that I'm caught up in my small self. Bless you. And my perception is really projection. And then finally, all perception, because it's mitigated by our body-mind, is mitigated by what's going on in our head, then we have to recognize that it's our job. It's no one's out there is going to be paying attention to what's going on inside of our own mind. And if we're not recognizing that the moment that we feel emotionally altered, that's a signal that I have to begin to locate where that place is in me that life circumstance has mirrored, has touched. Because that place that is touched is a part of me that's living in the disconnect. And so it's my work to go there and find that connection, to rescue little Gary, if that's the part of that process, to really own what's going on so I can be a part of the reconciliation that needs to happen within my own soul. Bless you. So, Jay and I have been reading Metahuman by Deepak Chopra, which is his latest book. It's on the same level of becoming supernatural as Joe Dispenza. It's one of those miraculous gifts to the awakening consciousness of the planet. And in Metahuman, Deepak Chopra, he really talks about our capacity as that lives beyond our sense of conditioned self. And so you know that you're living in a virtual reality, or what can be described as your own personal reality, when it's filled with all these focuses and connections to what's happening in the outer. But if we turn our attention to what Deepak describes as meta-reality, as being able to have an awareness that lives in the same context as our higher self, then if we can bring that mind into our current effort to kind of be with what's happening, but out of a greater awareness, we would find ourselves being able to use whatever we're having as our abundance. And so if everything that we have in some no uncertain terms is our abundance, and yet we are in the same moment pushing this away because it looks and feels against us, we have to reconcile the part of us that is having our life be against us, when the principle is that if we could see it as it really is, we would know that it was something that was sent to us to use, because it was a stepping stone to our next level of greatest good. I'm going to share a short clip of Deepak explaining what he means by meta-reality, this reality that enables us to be with whatever experience that we might be having, and translate that into something that leads us into a greater expression of our wholeness and worth. Check it out.
If the world is a projection of our mind, and our conditioned mind, then by deconstructing what we assume to be reality, we can participate in the creation of a new reality.
Here we have environmental problems. The Earth is at the brink of mass extinction. What is the practical way?
See, the problem is right there, environment. There's no such thing as an environment. Mm. It's your extended body.
Yeah.
And, this air is your breath. And those trees are your lungs. The earth is recycling as your body. The rivers and waters are your circulation. The atoms in your body are stardust that is recycling right now. So you have a personal body, you have a universal body, they're both equally yours. To call that the environment is already creating the subject-object split. We need that inner transformation, which is a spiritual transformation, and then everything will happen spontaneously. Otherwise, it's just words. We are an activity of the universe looking at itself through a human nervous system. This is an observation deck for the universe to look at itself. Mm.
Why do we get people who are bent on destruction, and then, if this is the same mechanism?
Our collective projected conditioning has created an insane world. You know, the Course in Miracles starts with this statement. What you're looking at is insanity right now.
It is insanity. No, yes. It is. It's totally
and
insanity.
And we take it to be normal. It's the psychopathology of the average that we call normal.
So let's talk about what a meta-reality then looks like.
Meta-reality is infinite possibilities every moment, infinite creativity every moment, synchronicity or non-local correlation every moment, surrender to uncertainty every moment, harnessing the power of attention, intention, insight, intuition, imagination, creativity, vision, and higher calling every moment, and transcendence, and living from the source.
That's a new reality.
All right, so wouldn't you want to embody all those things that he just said? Fixed. Okay. So what if we were to really embody that dimension of ourselves where we're constantly in contact with our higher self, that we see that uncertainty and what is hidden is really welcomed, and we are really present to whatever's happening in our life, to cultivate that capacity and seeing it as being something that we can bring to the cares and concerns that are present in our life, and especially as we look out at our broader human family's condition. So Jane has, we were driving to Kettle Falls, or from Kettle Falls, and I was remarking how little concern that I have about contracting the coronavirus. I have no fear. And I was marveling at that, and Jane and I were both discussing how, yeah, it just seems like we're not bothered by this as much. And so she suggested that I talk about this as a part of my talk. And so my challenge is to try to offer a context for how to be in this dynamic of the coronavirus and the epidemic and what's happening, and be able to kind of see that we all possess the capacity to align with this experience in a way that really can free us from some serious worry or stress about what's happening. So the primary thing is fear. And if we can recognize that if we're afraid, that we need to kind of work with what's going on underneath that. So to really look at what's being touched by the coronavirus as you consider this. And for those of us who are elderly, or if we have a compromised immune system, there is legitimate cause for concern. But in the greater reality of things, when we consider all the ways in which we can be exposed to some potential threat or bodily harm, there's a lot more that can fill the screen than just what we're experiencing. And so in no uncertain terms, we have a situation that's blown to such an extreme place of prominence in our life, because that's our culture and society. In our current political climate, we blow everything up, and then we attach meaning to it, and we bring people into all kinds of energy around this, and it works us up. But the truth be known, it's more dangerous to actually go to a hospital to receive care. More than 100,000 people a year just die of being in a hospital. And so as we pull some context in, we can kind of see, yes, for those who are really vulnerable, we need to be concerned and cautious. But for the most part, for the rest of us, we can bring a sense of knowing that while this is challenging for people, that we can work with whatever fear arises in this and know that there's a greater mind at work through all this. So I'm going to end this particular story by saying that last night we had some folks come over to look at our bicycles that we're trying to sell as we're trying to unload our personal possessions because we don't want to move them. So they came by to look at the bicycles, and it was a young family and they had kids in the car, and they came up and then I went over and shook their hands and introduced myself and saw the kids, and then I realized that the thought occurred to me that, well, but you should go wash your hands right now. that was the voice that came in my head. And I thought to myself, no, wait a minute, is that coming from a place of fear? I'm remembering Jane and our conversation about not having any fear around the virus. And so I had to stop and I had to sit and go in and really ask for guidance. What is this urge I'm feeling to wash my hands? Is it connected to any fear? And the voice said, no, it's connected to you being responsible. So you need to go and wash your hands because you're going to be with your congregation tomorrow. You're going to be with people that need to know that you're going to do the right thing and make sure that you're not contributing to the hysteria that's going around with respect to this that's happening. So the message that I'm trying to convey is that when we come from a spiritual place, we can truly both be in the world and not of it. And the not of it part of it is that we don't have to invest our emotional self in believing that there's something out there that can diminish us or even ultimately destroy us. You know, I've had my life on the line on a number of occasions, and in my experience, I have never felt unsafe. And I can count on that. And I know not everybody has that capacity, but everybody can develop that capacity if you begin to work in consciousness as opposed to work with what's out there. So last thing I'm going to say is that I shared this slide at the end of my last talk, and the steps still really apply, that when we're trying to bring forth a greater presence to whatever that we're having, we have to begin with gratitude, independent of how the situation looks or feels unto us. And we have to recognize that in part how it looks and feels unto us is coming from within us. So if we push this away, we're pushing out away the very thing that we need to welcome that helps us have access to this part of ourselves that's still living in the disconnect. And then with curiosity, we have to really investigate, well, how is it possible that I'm making this the matter with me? What is that connected to? What belief do I have within myself that this is really trying to get my attention? And then finally, and then subsequently to that, to recognize there's still a part of myself, little Gary, that's living in this belief that he's not enough or that he's a disappointment. And I have to work with that part of myself by bringing love and compassion to it. And then ultimately to take authentic action. And the action that I seek to take nowadays is really investing my energy into really awakening myself. And so to that aim, and this is the last thing I'm going to say, I'm going to be conducting a book study on the metahuman, on Deepak Chopra's book, starting in next month in April. And it'll be on Thursday mornings from 10 to 11:30, and it'll be for about 7 weeks. And we're going to be working with that book because he has a very practical and easy and powerful 31-day practice of awakening. So it's a daily practice, it takes 5 minutes, you do it 3 times a day, and in 31 days, you are wide awake. God bless. Thank you.